Hello and welcome to Talking Law, the podcast where you can hear barristers, judges, solicitors, managing partners and more talk about their careers and experiences and lives in the law. I'm Dr. Sally Penny. I'm a barrister at Cunworthy's Chambers in Manchester. I'm the founder of Women in the Law UK and its CEO. Today, I'm delighted to be interviewing Anne Franca, OBE. Anne is the Chief Executive Officer of the Chartered Management Institute, the UK's leading professional body for management and leadership. She's an expert in management and leadership in the workplace and was awarded her OBE in 2020 for services to workplace equality. In this interview, you'll hear Anne talk passionately about equality in the workplace and how all organisations can do more to promote women into leadership positions, including law firms. Anne also tells me some of the wellbeing initiatives that have been implemented at CMI and why they're crucial for all organisations to foster a healthy working environment. But before we get to that, I asked Anne to tell me how she got to her role at CMI and what the organisation actually sets out to do.
Prior to CMI, I spent almost 30 years in the corporate environment, actually in a number of multinational companies, Procter & Gamble, Mars, a couple of FTSE 100 companies, Boots, for example. And obviously, laterally, I was in very senior positions, not obviously, but luckily, laterally, I was in very senior positions in some of those companies, C-suite positions. And so really, the transition to being chief executive of CMI, which is all about turning accidental managers into better conscious and inclusive leaders, was a very natural one because I'd had 30 plus years of experiencing what it's like to be both a manager and leader and be managed and led by others. And I think what we all know is when you are managed and led well, you thrive, you achieve, you have a great culture, you grow and develop, and you deliver your results. When you are managed and led badly, as so many of us unfortunately still are, then the opposite is true. And you suffer, your work suffers, the culture suffers, the company suffers. And actually, your well-being outside of work suffers. So really, being chief executive of CMI is a role I take very seriously because when you have good management and leadership, a skill which can be learned, you benefit at all levels. As an individual, your team benefits, your organization benefits, and of course, ultimately, society benefits. So it's a very important position.
Yeah. And actually, I ought to point out that in all those really quite high-level roles prior to becoming another high-level role, as a chief executive, you will have been dealing with a lot of lawyers, corporate, commercial, general counsel within your own organizations, of course, and of those on the other side. So I suppose maybe I should just start very quickly here before I move on to my vast amount of questions for you. Well, I shall save it till the end about the tips of the best lawyers you came across, what they did. From a client perspective, that was great. So you can think about that at the end. I'm going to ask you,
Absolutely. I think one of the things that got me off to a very good start in my career was that I actually liked working with the lawyers. You know, I was never afraid of them. I knew that it was always going to be a discussion about what claims could we make, for example, about our products. You know, how could we come up with creative solutions? I like to think of, for example, the corporate lawyers that were advising on advertising policy and claims. I like to think of them as creative partners. We were there to come up with a great solution that didn't put anybody at undue risk, but still got our message across. And I think that this is the way in which people need to approach their work with lawyers. I think lawyers are very skilled, creative, insightful people, but they need to be treated as such. And they need to be treated as partners rather than as naysayers. You know, too many people treat lawyers as, oh, they're the ones saying no. And I think this is very short-sighted, both for the client and for the lawyer. It doesn't really respect either side.
Absolutely. Now, Anne, tell me about CMI, because, you know, I'm a companion of CMI and a chartered manager, and as are you. Many organizations, including vast amounts of law firms, solicitors firms, Silex, organizations which are giving legal apprenticeships, have signed up to CMI qualifications and indeed CMI courses worldwide. And you've got like a vast amount of a community. So what is the community? How many are there? And what do you do? Because it's a really powerful organization, also with a vast amount of free resources.
Well, it is a great question. CMI is actually, we're 76 years old this year. So we were founded right after the Second World War by the British government initially. And our purpose, which is still our purpose, is to help raise British productivity through helping people to become better leaders and managers. And this is very much our mission. We say, let's turn accidental managers into conscious, capable, inclusive leaders. Now, that is as much of a mission now as it was 75 years ago. In fact, Sally, we have over 200,000 in our community, but there are 8 million managers in this country. It's an incredibly widespread popular occupation. And in fact, most people, and this is a startling statistic from very recent research, a whopping 82% of people who go into their first managerial role have absolutely no training in management or leadership. They're functional experts, like they're great lawyers. Well, that's fabulous. But then one day somebody says, congratulations, you're the managing partner. Have they told you how to manage yourself or others or resources? No. So you make it up as you go along. Now, this has consequences, and they're mostly not good. There are a few of us who have that natural gift, but for most of us, this is a skill, just like learning the law. We need to learn how to manage, how to lead, how to recognize the impact of our own behaviors on others, how to listen, how to have difficult conversations, how to coach, how to direct resources, how to set clear objectives. All of these things that are so important, and they are skills that can be learned. And this is why CMI exists. And we have, as I said, 200,000 people in our community. 150,000 of those are learners on our various qualifications, because that's how we turn accidental managers into capable leaders. We help them to learn, because this can be learned, and we do it practically. This isn't theory. This is not exam-based. This is, how do you apply good principles of management and leadership in your work? How do you reflect on what you've done, and how do you learn and improve?
And so what I really wanted to ask you, because CMI have done lots of important research and work into, you know, everyone's economy, age, culture, race, gender. But I often say, don't I, whenever I see you, that I wonder if there will be less of tribunal cases if we had better managers.
Oh, absolutely there would be. And in fact, not to put lawyers out of business, because I do know that employment law is a very important branch of the law, and one for which I have a great deal of respect. But so many tribunal cases could, in fact, be avoided if people were better managers and leaders, if they communicated more clearly, if they were more aware of the impact of their behavior on others, if they were more respectful, if they were more inclusive. And, you know, these are things, again, as I said, that can be learned through practical application as well as practical study. And this is why, again, CMI exists. So indeed, actually, it would be great, I'm sure, for the lawyers to have more meaningful cases and not the many cases that are born out of just, let's face it, some sloppy or perhaps ill-informed or amateur management and leadership practices. That does waste a lot of people's time.
Yeah. It's a really important point, isn't it? Because I'm very keen for people, you know, I'm a real learner. I love learning. You know, lawyers actually are the end of the food chain. And I always say this, but prevention is better than cure. If we can just avoid getting there. And let's face it, look, litigation and tribunals and, you know, court cases are expensive, whether here in the UK, because this podcast has 4 million listeners, you know, in 12 countries. So whether it's in America or here or, you know, in Asia, the global community, it's expensive. So avoidance is much better, prevention is better than the cure. But I wonder, who are members of this of CMI? Are they just PLCs? Or, you know, who are these people who subscribe? And also, have you got kind of this community of tiny little organizations and businesses as well? I know John Lewis is one of them, and, you know, that's huge. But then you've got others. So what is the community and what do they look like?
Right. Well, that's a great question. And one of the things I'm most proud about and enjoy most about my work at CMI is the huge variety of individuals, professions, functions, backgrounds that we have. So we have people that are just starting out in management roles. We have middle managers. We have senior managers and CEOs. We have them from the public sector, things like the civil service or the NHS or the police force or other public sector bodies. We have them from the private sector. You mentioned John Lewis. We have a number of people in the private sector in larger companies and also many members who are in small and medium-sized companies. And we also have individuals who are practicing on their own, either as consultants or coaches. So it's a huge variety, as I say, at all levels and from all functions, you know, the legal function, the HR function, the IT function, sales, finance, you name it, we've got it. And one of the things that benefits our members is that exchange from a very broad-minded group. And this is important, I think, for the legal community. Oftentimes, we do tend to surround ourselves with people from our own sector or our own slice of life or our own professional community. And that can sometimes be very rewarding, of course, but it also can sometimes limit us and blinker us a bit because, you know, after all, it's a room full of lawyers. Yes. They've all been taught the same thing in the same way, and right? And what we do at CMI is by mixing those sectors, mixing the levels, mixing the experiences, you suddenly realize you have a lot more in common. There's a certain universality. And what binds the CMI community together is that you actually do care about how you manage and lead others, what the impact on that is, not only for yourself, but for your team and for your organization, because you know it makes a very big difference. And we can learn from each other.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And indeed, I think, you know, Tamara Bax, or Box, Tammy, who's a guest or has been a guest on this podcast from Green Smith, she's a member of CMI and a companion. So, you know, what we're talking about is very applicable to our sector. I want to ask you about a general passion that we both have on gender balance in the workplace. And indeed, you're the author of, you know, How to Create a Gender Balanced Workplace, which is a book published by Penguin. It's a book that I use often in many cases. And it's really not here with me now because I've lent it out again or just get people to buy it. Because long before, you know, there were other books on the issue, yours is a very practical one. I ought to say for completeness that you've also written another book, a management book, which is very practical, which is published by the Financial Times. But we have a passion about the workplace being gender balanced and equal. And indeed, some of the leadership you've brought to CMI have been about that. And so just very quickly, I suppose, how do you think we can improve our gender balance? Because in law, the entrance level is largely women. It's about 54%. For agents, it was a 52% for solicitors. And so we're kind of tipping over the other way, in a way. But of course, in the senior levels, that is not replicated at all in leadership, that there are few women. It's improving, but we're getting better. And on my section of the legal community, of barristers, there's even less. Indeed, you came to one of my dinners, and it was quite apparent there, the few women that there were. What are your views about improving gender balance in the workplace? And any tips or guidance that you can offer before people rush out and buy your book? Because it's a very, very good book.
Thank you. Thank you, Sally. Well, listen, there is no silver bullet, but what is striking to me is that the profile that you shared where you have over 50% of the entry level of solicitors being women. You know, this is a profile that exists in many, many other sectors and organizations. Yes. So, for example, it's the same in the medical profession. It's the same in the financial services profession, in many corporate professions, that around about 50% of the entry-level positions are indeed taken by women. And this is because now more women are going to university. As we know, they tend to get better grades and they get great jobs when they graduate. The issue occurs when we talk about progression. This is where things really start to fall off. I call it the glass pyramid, because as you move up through the ranks in organizations, whether it's a law firm or a bank or indeed many other professions, the percentage of women versus men becomes less and less. So what's happening is women are getting hired in, but they're not progressing. They're not getting promoted in the same proportionality as men. So you might go from 50% in the bottom 25%, the bottom quartile, but then it drops, say, from 50% to 40% in that second quartile. And then as you move up to the third, it may drop to 30%. And in that top quartile, it may be 20% or less. This is the glass pyramid that I refer to. So what needs to happen is we need to pay much more attention to retention and progression. And when we look into those characteristics, that's when culture as well as policy plays a huge role. So it's, you know, how flexible are you with regards to things like career breaks, with regards to things like stretch assignments for perhaps women that have taken time off to have children. It becomes much more important when it comes to giving people fair promotional opportunities and not assuming that they perhaps won't want that opportunity because of other commitments. And it really means that we have to be very aware not only of our cultural practices, but of our data. So do you measure, if you're in a big law firm, do you measure how many of your entry level are progressing? And if you have that 54% female intake for your trainees, how many are then actually signing up for your first level roles? And then when you promote them to that next level up, how many are getting promoted? So you've really got to track. And then if you find things are skewed, you know, say your promotion rate is twice for men what it is for women, what is true in many professions, then you have to zero in and say, ah, why? Let me do some digging and correct that. Because the talent is there, as you've seen, you've hired them in. It's about progressing and creating a culture where that progression is welcomed and they feel included and they feel they're given the same opportunities.
Absolutely. And of course, we know, you know, speaking as a Black woman, that the position is actually even worse for minority, Black and ethnic minority women. Actually, in terms of the progression, because that's some of the work you've been doing at CMI specifically is on race. And if I may say so, there's an annual dinner each year with companions who are nominated and have to be elected as companions of CMI. It's quite a prestigious role, even though it sounds a bit like, when I say to my children, you know, I'm a companion, I think they think I'm just escorting somebody around. which of course isn't what the title and the election is about. But at the dinner each year, and especially at this year, which is the President's Dinner, it's a celebration of a number of awards, I was struck by how diverse that room was. And some might say, you know, I'm quite open to, in the spaces that I go to where it's poor and the representation isn't there. It was really quite representative. And I don't mean just from the top in terms of Dame Sharon White to some of the juniors who were newly elected companions. I felt that across there. So is race one of the issues that, because you cover in the book in terms of culture and progression of women and minority women, is that, you know, something close to your heart, both personally and in the work of CMI?
Yes, we work very hard on that. I'm glad that you noticed the diversity of the room. That is not by accident. We work very hard to be truly inclusive. And you mentioned earlier our work on the Everyone Economy. It was a project we did for our 75th anniversary. It was a big piece of research. There we looked at a number of different protected characteristics. So we looked at gender, we looked at race, we looked at age, we looked at socioeconomic background, we looked at disability. And we actually took a very thorough look, both qualitatively and quantitatively, at what was holding people back and their lived experiences. And we found a number of things. I mean, some of them, you know, not particularly encouraging. We found that over half of all people felt at some point held back in their career progression by who they were. So it's still very widespread. We also found something which I think is very germane and important, and something that I would caution all legal firms against, something that we call the say-do gap, which is to say that when we ask people, how inclusive is your organization when it comes to X, very high percentages, 80 to 90%, will say, oh, very inclusive, where X is, say, race or disability. And then we say, okay, great. Can you name one concrete program that you're involved in or that you're aware of that your organization is doing to help deal with this, to help improve this? And then suddenly that percentage drops from 85, 90% to 44, 24, even 5%, I think is the lowest. Now that big gap is what we call the say-do gap. And so many firms fall prey to this. And this is where you've got on your website how committed you are to diversity and inclusion and the wonderful diversity officers you have and the wonderful programs that you have. But in the end, are you actually achieving it in your data sets? Are you achieving it when you look around your rooms? Do you see visible manifestations of people of color, people with disabilities? Obviously, some other traits are harder. I mean, you could say age, but gender, things like socioeconomic background, sexuality may be harder, but you still need to work to make sure that you're being representative. And that's really what we strive for, because as you will know, and it's quite interesting this also for all of the lawyers, one of the seminal pieces of research on the power of diverse thinking was actually done with juries. And you know, you may be aware of this, Sally, right? Where they were looking at the impact of diversity in jury decisions. And where you have people of very diverse characteristics, you tend to get more considered and better decisions because you have less groupthink. Because people have people in the room with different perspectives who disagree with them, and that makes them pay more attention to the evidence and the arguments. And that actually leads you to better debate and better decisions, which obviously are a bedrock of the legal system, right? Jury by your peers. You want those people to take good decisions. So it's absolutely essential to the well functioning of our legal system that we have diverse participation all over, in the barristers, in the solicitors, in the judges, and in the jury.
Absolutely, absolutely. I am glad you raised that study because I am aware of it. It's phenomenal. And actually, I should say another study that I use often is about, you know, the McKinsey report. And I noticed one of the Gold Cup winners or Lifetime Achievement winners, when I became a companion, God, feels like years ago now, was Dame Vivian Hunt. And she at the time was heading up McKinsey, I think. She's still at McKinsey, of course. It was on profit, wasn't it? You know, more diverse boards and more profitable. I mean, the report might be a bit older. And so this sort of say-do gap sticks with me, because so often people say, yeah, we've got loads of this, loads of that. And then you think, but do they feel included? And are they progressing? Are they in leadership roles? So it's really, really spot on. Can I just ask you about apprenticeships, which are kind of a buzzword in the legal sector? Because Silex, which is Chartered Institute of Legal Executives, have been doing that for years. You know, you work on the job and you're paid. It takes you longer, but you qualify usually as a solicitor. So you could do it if you're a secretary or what. In fact, Donna Scully, a podcast guest, that was her route. But now in the legal sector, we've got lots of legal apprenticeships that people can do in a variety of ways. But apprenticeships are a big part of CMI. And when you did the piece last year, the 75-year anniversary research, it was great to sort of meet particularly women who were of a certain age, you know, somewhere older than you and I, who suddenly decided to have a career change. You know, the truck driver, I spent a lot of time talking to her, to the young woman who worked on the underground in management. So it seems like apprenticeships are catching. Do you think they're catching? Because I know you've been dealing, you know, CMI have been talking about apprenticeships and managing them for years. But do you think now is the time for us to give equal measure and credence to the importance of apprenticeships?
Well, the short answer to that is yes. We've done a lot of research on management and leadership apprenticeships. Those have been growing in popularity. They're very much liked by both the apprentices and employers, which is why, you know, let's not forget the apprenticeship program is employer-led. And so the standards that are created and the programs that are created reflect what employers want. And the fact that management and leadership apprenticeships are so popular is because employers like them. And many employers choose them. Now, they're also extremely popular with the apprentices. And that is very important because, for example, we know from our research that they are contributing, these apprenticeships are contributing in an extremely positive fashion to social mobility. So some staggering statistics, 71% of management apprentices, 71% come from families where neither parent went to university. Now, that's a staggering statistic. And of course, they want to, once they complete an apprenticeship, they want to pay it forward. So 97% of management apprentices say that now that they appreciate the training that they've had, they want to train and develop their direct reports. And indeed, we know that our apprentices have generated, on average, several hundred thousand of additional revenue for their businesses. One of the apprentices at the event you referenced grew their company by 60% thanks to the things she discovered being an apprentice, and they won a Queen's Sustainability Award. So these are incredibly powerful developmental tools, and I heartily endorse them, not just for managers and leaders, but for the legal profession. Because learning and practical learning on the job and then reflecting on what you've learned is always a very powerful method.
Yes, absolutely. And I ought to say, actually, one of the CMI members, Cordella Bart Stewart, OBE, was one of the pioneers of what's called the SQE in the solicitor's branch of the profession, the solicitor's qualification exam, which is another way of an apprenticeship, you know, learning on the job and then later on, you know, qualifying as a solicitor. And it seems to be, you know, another good route to link the apprenticeships as a qualification. And actually for university students, because I gather from Heather Melville, Dr. Heather Melville, another mutual friend of ours and another director of CMI and a companion, that at her university, because she has become the Chancellor of York University, that apprenticeships are actually a real life option, particularly in social mobility. Because you're, of course, you know, you've got a clear career plan rather than the traditional routes, if you like, that perhaps, you know, the likes of me and you probably took in our earlier careers.
Yes.
I want to ask you about well-being, because it's big. You know, my branch of the profession is long hours. It's quite hard. I don't say that out of pride for it. It's just a bit of a realistic action option of what it's like. You know, being a barrister, boxes being delivered to the house and preparing cases and for the solicitor's branch. So what do you do for well-being? And the reason I ask is that you did a report on sort of the exiting of sort of people from the workplace in later years, post-pandemic, and wellness and well-being was one of the reasons. It was part of the everyone's economy. And so, you know, what do you do for well-being? How important is wellness or well-being to businesses? You know, having the whole-rounded employee, if you like, because you've done a bit of work on that as well. And obviously, the culture and the working environment has changed post-pandemic. You know, lockdown, we did lots of webinars on managing teams remotely. And now we're talking a lot about getting people back in offices, flexible working and so on. Some of that is tied up in wellness. So what do you think about wellness and well-being, and what do you do for your own?
So it's a very important question, and it's a dramatically important part of management and leadership. So, for example, the biggest impact on your well-being at work is your relationship with your line manager. Our research and the research of our previous chair, Lord Mark Price, shows the same thing. That is, and McKinsey's research shows the same thing. It's the biggest impact on your well-being is your relationship with your line manager, and the biggest impact on your engagement at work is your relationship with your line manager. And in our study that we did just this year on Better Managed Britain, we saw that in instances where people felt that they did not have an effective line manager, over half of those people were thinking of leaving the organization. So if you're not well managed and your manager is not looking after your well-being, it has a huge and negative impact, not only on you as an individual, but on your results and on the culture. So it has to be taken seriously. That's the first thing. This is not fluffy stuff. This is about better business results, better outcomes, better achievement of your organizational objectives. So that's the first thing I would say. So take it seriously. The second thing I would say is it's not that hard to take it seriously. People often think they need very complicated initiatives and this and that. You don't. You just need to listen. You need to make people feel valued. You should encourage people to feel safe to express their views, like you're not going to bite their head off or shut them down. You should actually check in and ask how people are feeling and try to look for the positives and say, you know, you did a really good job on that, Sally. Thank you so much. I appreciate you. Because don't forget, praise is free, and it's one of the biggest well-being boosters around. Other tips for well-being, and we do this at CMI, we have early finish Fridays. You know, we always say, as long as we're more productive, we don't care. You can finish at 2 o'clock on a Friday. We've been doing it now for, I think, over 2 years. Well, we continue to grow. We continue to thrive, and people love it. Occasionally, if people have been working really hard, we'll throw in a well-being day where we'll just say, I think the last one we did was the King's coronation. It was going to be a 3-day weekend. We said, here, have that Friday off, make it a 4-day weekend. Now, people, you know, that might seem like, why are you doing that? Well, I'll tell you why, because they repay you in much more than what that day or that early finish costs. They repay you with their engagement, with their loyalty, with their retention and their commitment. They deliver more for you. So it always, you know, puzzles me when people think that this is a negative or somehow a fluffy thing. It's not. It will deliver hard and fast better results for you. And by the way, if you completely ignore it and you treat your people terribly and you're a slave driver and, you know, you're making them work all hours and you just shut them down, eventually it's going to come back to bite you, because I go back to my incoming statistic. If you're not a good manager, over half your workforce is thinking, boy, I'm out of here in the next 12 months. And we see this in the law, unfortunately. Many of the diverse talents that exit the legal profession before they become senior are doing so because of the culture, because they feel overworked and undervalued. Yes. And I think that many legal managing partners and partners would be well advised to take a look at their own working practices. And, you know, this is not about expensive well-being programs, which I know many law firms have. This is really about, okay, if you are a senior lawyer managing more junior lawyers, how are you treating them? Do they feel valued? Do they feel listened to? Do they feel appreciated? Are you looking after their well-being? Because that's how you'll get them to stay.
You know, our women in the law, we've got thousands of members and increasing. And the thing that gets most interaction from our page, and there are like 43,000 people following the page, are conversations about well-being and wellness. It's astonishing, you know, yes, about the law, but, you know, it assumes that those following us are competent and capable. But it's conversations about wellness and well-being. So I really, really get that. Now, Anne, as we record this, is the myths or the post-saga of Bates and the post office, the Horizon scandal. And that is about the work of a lawyer to bring about, you know, a gross miscarriage of justice for a number of people. I wonder if you've got a favourite legal character yourself, you know, because the public have been appalled by what the scandal, but impressed by, you know, the lawyer's ability to bring this case to light. And of course, the drama has done that. But I wondered if, you know, you, like the public, who love legal dramas, you know, from Ally McBeal to Rumpole, have got a favourite legal character from a book or a TV series. And then I wanted to ask you about a book, your favourite book that you've read and why.
Okay. Well, so it's very interesting. I've been thinking about that question. And you're right. People love legal dramas, don't they? Right? There's so many of them. And actually, I think the case you mentioned, isn't that a wonderful example of how the court of public opinion really resulted in moving the needle on a real legal case and delivered a commensurate and long overdue outcome? And that's quite powerful, isn't it? Yes. Right? So that's something that's really quite remarkable. But there's so many legal characters I've loved. And indeed, one of my all-time favorite movies, I've got to say, was Legally Blonde. Yes. Look at that. We've been talking about the challenge of stereotypes. We've been talking about gender balance. You know, that was a really great uplifting film about somebody that was stereotyped all the wrong way and went on to challenge those assumptions and prove their worth and stick up for their intelligence and be respected as an individual at a time when they were being dismissed. So that's great. But you've mentioned Ally McBeal. There is The Good Wife, right? And then, of course, you know, there's also The Lincoln Lawyer. I mean, both sides of the pond, and in fact, globally, I think lawyers have fascinated us. There's Columbo, right? There's To Kill a Mockingbird. I think I'm hard pressed. Even I guess lawyers and doctors are up there in the dramas, right, that shape our worlds. But they're very, very popular. And I do think that that reminds us all that actually the legal profession matters to people, and the issues that the legal profession deals with matters to people. And therefore, how you behave as a lawyer matters. Yeah. Right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And have you got a favorite book? Doesn't have to be. We've got a book club, Women in the Law. So we're always looking for good books to read, and we invite the authors.
One of the things I would say is that I've become, I'm a content consumer. I consume so much content. You know, I know you do as well, Sally, yeah. Because all the studies and reports we're always reading, and they're always trying to grab our attention. And unfortunately, because of the digital explosion of content, both video and the written word, I probably don't read as much as I should or as I used to. But one of the books I read recently that I really loved, and it reminds me again of a book that challenged norms and assumptions in science, and that is Lessons in Chemistry. What I loved about it is, you know, it was very pointed about all of the, let's face it, you know, challenges, I wanted to use a less politically correct word to describe what she had to put up with, of women in science and women with brains and that era. And, you know, the way she overcame all of that, of course it's humorous, but it's also, there's a lot of tragicomedy in there, and that, you know, some of the issues that she had to deal with in terms of her own harassment were pretty horrendous. And unfortunately, that stuff still happens.
So, Anne, I want to return to the question I asked you in the beginning, and it was about what makes a good lawyer in your experience, I suppose, as a consumer from being an employer of lawyers, when you're in business, you know, in your other roles before CMI, but also, you know, from GCs, you know, what have been the skills or the qualities of the lawyers that you've admired? Don't say the bad ones, because we can easily spot those.
But no.
What have been sort of, you know what I mean? The good skills, because it's very easy to be at the other end.
Yes.
And be saying, as the lawyer, well, that's not good. So throughout that all, from the consumer's end, I suppose.
So I'll give you a couple of examples. What I really admire most in lawyers is I think really good lawyers have a very astute emotional intelligence, and they're exceptional judges of character and people, and they use that to adapt accordingly to situations, rather than simply, you know, the rote application of the law. They really think about what would be the best outcome in this particular set of circumstances for these particular individuals. And I can give you an example from my own personal life, which I think is, you know, illustrative of this. So many years ago, when I first came to this country, I was married to he's a friend now, but the marriage was not going to survive. And I needed to get, we divorced. And of course I had a divorce lawyer, and they were doing their job because we were both in international careers. And they suggested to me, you know, look, if you really, you're in an international career, you know, it was at that time Procter & Gamble, they're going to want to move you all over the world. If you want to do that, you're going to have to probably leave the UK, because in the UK, the legal system will tie you to staying here because your daughter's here, your father, the father of your daughter's here, you're here. So anyway, we came up with a plan where I would actually move to my husband that I was divorcing, to his home country, because how could my husband possibly object to me moving to his home country, right? Which was not the United States, which was my home country. It was a European country. And so, you know, we went down this path, which was brilliantly crafted. I got a job in that home country. I found a school. I found a home. We were all set to go, except I was really I was not happy about this, because, you know, truth be told, Sally, I did not want to leave London. I did not want to return to that country. And I did not want to uproot my daughter and take her away from the proximity that she enjoyed to her father, or to, you know, her current situation. And my lawyer picked up on this. And one day she said to me, you know, Anne, you're an excellent witness. She was prepping me for that witness box. It was going to the High Court because of, you know, it was a very interesting legal situation where you had two non-British nationals battling it out in British court for custody of the child. And she said, I get the impression you don't really want to go through with this. I said, you're so right. I don't. And she said, well, you know what? We do not have to. Let's settle. And so right before we were going to that High Court, we had one last mediation meeting with the High Court judge. and my lawyer and my husband's lawyer, both very famous firms, right? You know, top divorce lawyers, because we did not mess around. And we reached an agreement whereby I would stay in the UK. Of course, it was never about taking my daughter away from her father, and he had full access, and, you know, and it all ended very well. Now, that's outstanding lawyering, isn't it? She read the room, she read me, and she, you know, she didn't do what was, you know, the one-sided winner-take-all, win-lose situation. She was nuanced and said, okay, I can see this. I can see that this outcome is not really what you want emotionally. So let's not go there. Let's craft an outcome that works for you, works for your daughter, works for your now ex-husband. And that, to me, is a great example of outstanding lawyering. And not surprisingly, that lawyer, can I mention them? It's Sandra Davies, Mish Kondureya, was named as one of the best divorce lawyers. And we still look back on that. We've, you know, and I'm still ever so grateful, and we've remained in touch. So that, to me, is a great example. And I think good lawyers do that. They don't just blindly follow the law. They look at the whole person. They look at the situation. And they try to find the best solution for everyone. Because that, rather than winner take all, win lose, you know, vicious retributions or draconian solutions, highly punitive, that in the long run is not really what's going to be in the best interests of any client or any situation.
I love that. And it's so important, because I often wonder if that is really the true skill, never mind, you know, passing all your exams. What you've described there is absolutely wonderful. And I don't have many questions left, but there is a question I wanted to ask you, is about commentary. So you've learned to use social media very well. Maybe you were trained like me, I don't know. But, you know, you're in the press, you're commenting, you talk a lot about the work of the CMI and the research and, you know, various projects going on. And whether it's in the FT or in the Times. And I love that. Is that a deliberate part of the role, or have you kind of embraced kind of the platforms that are available to talk about your work?
Well, I do think it's part of my role, because I go back to my incoming statement about CMI's mission, turning accidental managers into capable and confident and competent leaders. Yes. And a lot of people take that for granted. They don't think about it. They don't think about it as something they can learn. They don't really think about the impact it has on them as individuals or their organization's outcomes. And so we're constantly trying to raise the awareness of the importance of being a good manager and leader. And I cannot stress this enough. It makes a huge difference to individuals, to teams, and to organizations. And it is something that is also a huge driver of Britain's productivity. If we were to be better managed, we would have more productivity and more growth. And so one of the reasons we're constantly going public about this, whether it's me or my team with our research or commentary, is we're trying to bang that drum to remind people, because they so easily forget. And it's one of those things, you know, it's staring at you as plain as the nose on your face, but it's so easy to overlook and say, oh, that doesn't matter, because, you know, as long as you're a great barrister or a great finance professional, who cares how good you are as a manager and leader? And again, I say, you should care, because it makes a huge difference. And so that's why we're constantly reminding people.
Excellent. Now, Anne, you've been in leadership for a long time. That's what you are. You lead an organization enormous like CMI, which is changing people's lives, you know, not only individuals, but of course, companies and the culture and in the policies and research. And I know you've got a special birthday coming up. We don't need to say what the special is, but it didn't look anything like it. But I just wonder what's next. What about leading the country? Or what? You know, there's a general election year. Who knows?
Very funny, Sally. No. beyond Vicen. But I do think, honestly, we talked about the importance of management and leadership. I think the same is very true for politics. And I think that all, you know, one of the more, you mentioned some of the media work we do. Unfortunately, we did a survey, the Financial Times wrote about it. Only 30% of MPs think that management and leadership is important. And when they're talking about getting growth going, getting productivity going, creating a more inclusive society with greater opportunities for everybody that so we can really thrive. Yes. Again, management and leadership is so important. How our politicians treat each other, treat their staff, some of the less savory stories we've had and heard coming out are all about that. So I think, you know, yes, of course, I'm in my, as another companion of Eva Wittenberg Cox would say, I'm in my Q3, but I love what I do. I think it's very important. And I don't think, going back to our everyone economy, there is this assumption that, you know, once you hit a certain age, you're no longer valuable. Well, how ridiculous is that? And so, you know, there is no reason why people have to feel they have to give up their productive working lives. We may choose to do a variety of different roles. We may choose to do plural roles. For me, I'm certainly enjoying my role at the moment. I am absolutely not bored, and I have no intention at any time in the immediate future of stepping down. So we'll see what the future holds. There's loads of things I'm interested in and do as part of my work that I could take forward. But for now, it's still CMI all the way.
Thank you so much, Anne, for talking law with me in this interview. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on and learn so much for our community, legal community, all around.
Thank you so much, Sally. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I've thoroughly enjoyed our conversation, as always. Thank you so much.
Thanks to Anne Franca OBE for telling me all about her career on this podcast and her experience of the law. I want to let you know about some events coming up, key events, including the Penny Lecture Series, which returns on the 11th of June 2024, our annual conference, which takes place on the 22nd of November 2024, and our annual dinner, which is set for the 6th of March 2025. Early bird tickets are now available, I'm told. You can sign up to all events on the Women in the Law UK Eventbrite page and join our newsletter. If you'd like to support the Talking Law podcast, you can do so by getting in touch. And you can now help by using the Patreon app to donate. You can now follow me on Twitter at SallyPenny1, on Instagram SJSallyPenny, and on LinkedIn at Dr. Sally Penny MBE. There are plenty of other episodes of Talking Law for you to listen to with guests, including barrister turned stand-up comedian Chris Keogh. You can also hear the interview with Helen Pankhurst, the great-great-granddaughter of Emmeline Pankhurst, and Cherie Blair, CBE KC, the wife of former Prime Minister Tony Blair, and there are so many more episodes. Thank you so much to our production team at Purposeful Podcasts. I'm Dr. Sally Penny MBE. Bye for now.